States versus Haldar. Mr. Casper.
May it please the Court, I'm Kellen Casper. I represent the defendant, Sigarsan Haldar. Mr. Haldar was charged with a single count of conspiracy to defraud the United States by assisting Indian citizens in obtaining religious worker visas under the pretense that they would perform religious work at a temple in Milwaukee. He was not charged for being an illegitimate priest, nor for running an illegitimate or fake religious organization. Yet at trial, the government went well beyond the charge in the indictment, painting a picture for the jury of Mr. Haldar.
You know, there's something very strange about the way you brief this case. You, with a lot of ellipses, a lot of omissions and quotations, try to present the prosecutors having basically defamed your client and misrepresented the facts and so on. Then the government has a very forceful response in its brief. You file a reply brief. Your reply brief says nothing about what the government said in its brief.
Your Honor, I believe, I'll tell you what I believe we did respond to, and please inform me of
the point
what.
Is, they say you used ellipses in order to give a misrepresenting impression of what the prosecutor had said. And you don't respond to that.
I believe you do, Your Honor, and let me explain how. I believe if you're referring first to the pretrial promise that the government made to the court and defense counsel that they were not disputing that this was a legitimate religious organization, we do respond forcefully in our reply brief that I believe that's just incorrect. First of all, the acronym GVS stands for Gaudiya Vaishnava Society and defined in paragraph 4 of the indictment as Gaudiya Vaishnava Society, Inc. of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Not, as the government now contends, does not stand for Gaudiya Vaishnavism, that is the religion, also known as Hare Krishna. I believe they're just wrong on that point for two reasons. First, I just mentioned as to what the acronym actually stands for, but I believe there's no dispute that what the parties were talking about in that pretrial discussion was a religious organization. And the topic being discussed was the regulations for an R1 visa applicant, those requirements. The requirements specifically delineate between a religious denomination on the one hand and, on the other, a bona fide nonprofit religious organization. We're talking about the latter. That's essentially the 501c3 organization, eligible or actual. That is GVS Milwaukee. It's not the religion. That, at best, would be the religious denomination. That was not being discussed in that question.
Well, Mr. Casper, when I read that part of the transcript, I frankly wasn't sure what was meant. And I wasn't sure that people were using terms as precisely as they would be in a stock purchase agreement with carefully defined terms and so on. But to me, the most compelling evidence about the scope of this supposed promise was that nobody at trial seemed to think it had been broken. There was no objection. The trial court didn't respond. The defense counsel didn't think that there had been something.
I can't speak to what someone thought as to whether it was or was not broken at trial and whether that would cover insinuations of this kind. And I think it does in terms of whether they were disputing or not and trying to inject that issue into the trial. And we're not denying that the Rule 403 objection was ever made during trial, and we're not excusing that. I don't think that changes the prejudice to Mr. Haldar arising from this trial. I don't think that we can really interpret how defense counsel's failure to object and the resultant prejudice bears upon that promise. The promise is what it is. It was asked to GVS, and I think there are two interpretations potentially of that. I think the correct one is as to GVS Milwaukee, as defined in the indictment, or perhaps at the most broad, as we do say in our reply, both those temples in Milwaukee and their few affiliate temples in India. You could interpret that as the broader GVS, the Gaudiya Vaishnava Society. But that is not as broad as what the government requires that to mean, which is Gaudiya Vaishnavism, which is a 600-year-old religion also known as Hare Krishna, which includes many other completely unaffiliated organizations, such as the largest being ISKCON. I just don't believe there's any basis for the very broad interpretation that the government now requires to uphold its theory of it.
Well, if these guys admit that they're not priests and that they're over here for just to get here.
They do admit at trial that they came with the intention not to be priests but just to come to America. But, of course, the most relevant, the dispositive issue at trial was not their intent but Mr. Haldar's. And both parties at trial agreed essentially that at least two, if not all three, they did not have the intent to be religious workers. The issue, of course, was did Mr. Haldar know that and thus have the intent to defraud the United States?
And what's the purpose of the $25,000 or $30,000? That's the cost to get over here or something?
As the defense counsel at trial, both in opening argument and closing argument, laid out, the theory was that these were for expenses that Mr. Haldar incurred in bringing them over here, that the GVS, Milwaukee, and Mr. Haldar incurred any number of issues in bringing them over here that they were then required to repay, given that they had run out of the temple.
And so they go to work somewhere else. And
correct. Well, in some cases they did. There's one, that the fourth R1 visa applicant that the government did interview, Mr. Das, it appears went to another Hare Krishna temple unaffiliated with Gaudiya Vaishnava Society
evidence
in Florida.
It cost $20,000 to come to the United States and get this, visiting religious worker temporary visa.
I'm sorry, Aaron, did you say, was that in evidence?
Yeah, is there evidence that is the expense?
Sure. Well, I can't speak to the evidence on the amount, but there
isn't
evidence.
I'm asking about the amount.
Each of the applications did refer to the fact that it was the organization that bore the expenses in bringing these people to the United States.
Why is it such a huge expense? I'm just wondering whether there's any evidence with regard to Haldar's costs.
Your Honor, there
getting
are documents.
These people.
There are documents in the record. I'm not sure they were introduced at trial in any fashion.
Well,
but as to
okay, I'm not interested in what wasn't introduced in the trial.
Well, there, the liquidated damages clause of the employment contract was referred to, although those contracts were not introduced at trial.
I don't understand. Is there any evidence of the expenses he actually incurred to bring any of these people to the United States?
There is the evidence of the application saying that the expenses were
borne. Is there evidence of what the money was spent on?
There was the testimony of the witnesses that went back and forth on several issues as to whether they admitted that lawyers' fees were paid. There was conflicting evidence,
Any evidence about the size of any of the expenses?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe any of that was introduced at trial. Despite the pretrial promises and despite the obvious First Amendment implications of this argument to the jury, painting Mr. Haldar and GVS Milwaukee as fundamentally illegitimate and that he was overall just a bad guy, and despite the prosecutor's duty to avoid these kinds of improper suggestions and insinuations, the government went forward with this trial strategy.
What's the worst insinuation that they made about Haldar's
Your Honor,
character or religiosity?
I think the worst is Agent Labad's, I think, his first truly prejudicial statement, which is the 33% of all of these religious applications are not only fraudulent, but that when you look behind the curtain, there's, in his words, no organization, no temple, no church. He basically set up a binary system in which either they were legitimate or the organization itself was fundamentally fraudulent.
And that was, he was talking, those were sort of like national statistics, right?
That's correct,
he's trying to justify against an attack that hasn't come yet as to why the government is pursuing this, right?
That is the government's...
But in terms of what's... I've looked through that transcript, and I've Mr. Casper, it would be helpful to me. I didn't see anything that jumped out at me where I would say the district judge had to, just bang the gavel at that point and interrupt without an objection from defense counsel.
Your Honor, I think the 33% really just had the 33% and his descriptions of what those
right,
implied.
Right, but that's
no
not way. Specific to Mr. Haldar. I've got some questions for the government about that as well. But in terms of the attack that you're saying was made personally upon Mr. Haldar and his legitimacy and sincerity.
Well, following that 33% reference was the reference specifically to GVS Milwaukee. His description of why he was taking the photos was to see whether it appeared to be a religious organization or if there were any religious notifications outside of it. And then someone ran out from the temple very concerned, in Mr. Agent Labad's words, very concerned that he was taking this photo as alleged for that purpose. They advanced the ball in steps, Your Honor, and like the Shelton case out of the D.C. Circuit, just because it is kind of less direct than normal 404B kind of other acts evidence doesn't mitigate the prejudice on the defendant or the effect on the jury. It actually exacerbates it.
Well, I guess that I'm trying to think about this from the perspective of the judge managing the trial. At what point do you think that judge was obligated to step in?
I do believe it was that 33% count that at least a sidebar conference, in light of the pretrial concerns expressed about who was challenging what as far as this religious organization, I believe it, the issue was front and center. And also there had been an objection. We're not claiming necessarily that it preserved the issue for appeal, but as to Agent Labad's propriety of his testimony at all, based on prejudice from both the late arrival of the report under the Jenks Act, as well as it appears the substance thereof, based on the government's discussion at the time, offering to discuss with defense counsel off the record the substance of certain items that could be kept out. It wasn't just before trial that it was the late arrival or late availability of the document to defense counsel. It appears that it was the substance. So those two things together, the issue is not hiding from the judge generally, and I take your point that which one of these things required him to step in, but the issue wasn't hiding. The issue was front and center, and the prejudice is to the overall effect of this on the jury.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hanstead?
May it please the Court, Gregory Hanstead on behalf of the United States. The defendant constructed this appeal around a central theme, and that theme was that the government executed a trial strategy that was designed to inflame the passions of the jury through a series of what he refers to as insinuations about the fundamental religious illegitimacy of both Mr. Haldar and of Mr. Haldar's Milwaukee Temple. But the bases that he offers in support of that theme don't stand up. The defendant constructed a backdrop in his opening brief that included a suggestion, for example, that the government referred to Mr. Haldar's religion as a strange foreign religion. Now, that merits no more than a footnote in the defendant's reply brief, in which he explains that he was just using scare quotes when he put quotation marks around the words strange and foreign. But those quotation marks, the two sets of quotation marks, the one around the word strange, the one around the word foreign, appeared in the same sentence as two other sets of quotation marks that contained words that the government did use during its opening statement. If you strip away that foundation for the theme and look to the next one, the defendant claims that the government began the trial by sandbagging the district court and the defendant by making this assurance to the court and to the defendant that it was not going to challenge the legitimacy of Mr. Haldar or the bona fides of GVS Milwaukee. He then claims that the government reneged on that promise or that assurance by, again, insinuating, not by saying, but by insinuating that Mr. Haldar was an irreligious charlatan and that his GVS temple in Milwaukee was a total sham. First of all, again, the government didn't make that promise. He made no such promise. But secondly, the government didn't then proceed to make those insinuations. First of all, with respect to the nature of the government's promise, the parties have devoted a lot of time in their briefs to arguing about what it was that the government was assuring or promising in that exchange with Judge Randa. And it is possible to find places in the record, as the defendant has, where the letters GVS were used to refer to GVS Milwaukee.
What exactly is the fraud? I'm a little puzzled by this. So suppose you have... this presumably is a misrepresentation made to the State Department to get the visa? Is that the idea?
Correct.
And what exactly is the misrepresentation?
The misrepresentation, as alleged in the indictment, is that these applicants are qualified priests or are priests in
but
India.
Do they have to be priests? I don't understand. I mean, suppose some church says we like to have. Suppose it was something like the Rastafarians. And suppose they said, we really like to have Ethiopians do the maintenance and cleaning and so on in our churches, because we believe that Haile Selassie was a divine figure and so on. They're not priests, they're just sweeping the floor, but that part of our religion, we like to have these people doing this work in our churches. Now, would that be, wouldn't they still get the visas?
They could, and the representation...
You don't have to be a priest.
Right, and then there was...
You have to be a religious worker in some sense, right?
There were two parts to the misrepresentations here. One was that they were priests in India, but the more significant misrepresentation was that they intended to be priests or work in or perform religious work once they got to the United States.
But does it matter whether they perform religious work or they are from the homeland of the religion and the people in America are more comfortable having those people working in the church because they come from the home place of the religion. They're more authentic. So don't you get a visa for that? Do they have to be priests? I mean, you say they can be religious workers. What's the outer bound of a religious worker?
And certainly at trial, the defendant could have offered evidence that whatever these people were doing once they got to the United States, whatever they intended to do once they got to the United States, that was religious work. And there's some suggestion of that in the appeal briefs here. That is that...
But is the fraud here that these people were not actually going to be working in the temple? They do that for a little while, and then they go off and find a better job.
That's correct. The fraud.
That's the real fraud, isn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. And there's some suggestion in the reply brief that when one of these witnesses testified that he was going to be doing cooking and cleaning, that that's actually religious work. Well, that's the sort of evidence that could have been presented at trial, I suppose. It's certainly the sort of thing that could have been delved into on cross-examination of the government's witnesses and could have been argued in closing. But the mere fact that there might be these different interpretations as to what constitutes religious work...
How long did they, on average, work for Haldar before they went off to more lucrative employment?
Of the three witnesses that testified at trial, Gupreet Singh didn't work in the temple for Haldar at all once he got here. He immediately went to work at a convenience store.
Really?
And later driving a cab. Mr. Chopra and Mr. Kumar worked for some brief periods of time at the temple. I believe that the longest period was characterized as a couple or a few months.
Now these people will they then be deported?
They are subject to deportation. I think that
we know those wheels move very slowly.
They do, and they were held up a little bit because of the witnesses' cooperation in this trial. They gave them deferred agreements so that they could be present.
The notion that generally what happens with these people, if there is this fake stuff, is that they just disappear into the illegal immigrant population. Because these visas, are they indefinite or are they time limited?
They're time limited. Of the 14 that we have, when there's a question asked on the DS-156 application about how long the person intends to stay in the United States, most of them say 6 months. A couple of them say 2 years, and a couple of them say 3 years.
But do they, in fact, stay indefinitely, or do they...
That has been what's happening.
That's the concern, that they stay indefinitely.
And one of the agents who testified from the Department of Homeland Security testified about the difficulty that he had in tracking down these defendants, because there's really no obligation that's imposed upon the sponsoring organization to keep tabs on them.
They don't go to church, apparently.
Right.
Yeah, well.
Mr. Hanstad, I'd like to follow up on something that, that Mr. Casper raised, and that has to do with the evidence that Agent Lubod offered about the 33% fraud rate nationally and the contents or the fact of the tip that led the agents to look at
yes.
GVS in Milwaukee. Why on earth was that relevant, other than as, in essence, kind of a course of investigation, which is always playing with fire, both in terms of relevancy and hearsay?
Right. And with respect, first of all, to the tip evidence, that is probably the principal danger in tip evidence, relates to the admission of testimonial hearsay. And Williams and other cases set out the parameters for permissible background tip testimony. And here the government stayed well within those parameters, didn't delve into the nature of the tip at all, just the fact that there
was.
Why
was there a need to offer it at all?
Well, all that background testimony, both the tip testimony and the 33% testimony, was introduced simply as a hedge against any jury misimpression that this was arbitrary action.
A hedge against an attack that had not been made, right?
Well, that's correct.
I mean, that's very dangerous. You start, I mean, I'm trying to imagine a similar sort of argument or bit of background evidence with respect, let's say, to a tax fraud case. Or bank robbery is widespread in the United States and dangerous. Right? We don't do that. We don't allow that kind of testimony, do we? The judge instructs what the law is, what the law prohibits, and or methamphetamine is dangerous.
Well, and the case that the government cites, Garcia, mm-hmm. deals with some of that background testimony.
Mm-hmm.
It is relatively common to have, for example, drug agents testify that they use certain aggressive techniques in executing a search warrant or making an arrest because, based on their experience.
I'm aware of that. But when you're talking about whether you do the investigation at all, you're really playing with fire there. If I could just, with the indulgence of my colleagues, ask you about one other exchange in closing argument. Defense counsel was quoted as saying, the prosecutor expects you to believe that Mr. Haldar is up to no good because he has three guys that have perjured themselves in court and come and told you that they will do anything that it takes to stay in this country. You interrupted, Your Honor, I'm not sure that's the testimony. They didn't perjure themselves. The court, well, that's correct, so that will be noted. What on earth is meant in that exchange? Was Judge Randa vouching for the witnesses?
You know, I can tell you, and I think that if you look at the discussion of some proposed jury instructions at the close of trial, there's some discussion of that same point. And I can tell you that I was under the impression that, and it's not borne out by the transcript, but that we were talking about perjury that had been committed. There had been a finding that they committed perjury when they testified, for example, in the grand jury. And I think if you look at the discussion, again, of the proposed jury instructions about inconsistent statements, that's borne out there. And if I,
well, I'm trying to think. If I'm a juror listening to that exchange, it sounds like the judge might be vouching for the witnesses. They didn't perjure themselves. Well, that's correct.
Right. And again, what I had in mind when I made that objection.
I'm not asking what's in your mind. I guess I'm trying to understand how a juror would have understood that exchange.
Right. I think a juror could understand that exchange as being that there's been no formal finding that these defendants have lied.
That's a generous reading.
And Your Honor, if I know my time is up, but if I could just return very briefly to the question that you asked about the 33%.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to emphasize that these are not nationwide statistics. That is, the testimony wasn't that 33% of all of these applications are fraudulent. In fact, that was a question that was asked on cross-examination of Agent Lubad, and he specifically said that was not what he was saying. He was saying that in this earlier sample study, that sample study showed that 33% of the applications were fraudulent.
Of which sample? What sample of what set of applications?
He didn't specify where the pool came from, but again,
then what on earth was it doing in evidence? So
again, it was an explanation as to why it was that he was performing that site visit and why there was a site visit requirement in the first place. And I think that there's one hallmark of this being just background testimony and not sort of propensity testimony is that it wasn't raised, it wasn't discussed again throughout the trial. That is, the government didn't argue anything at all about that 33% figure. So it remained there. just as a hedge against any jury misimpression.
I missed this. What was your response to Judge Hamilton's question about tip testimony?
The principal danger of tip testimony is that you will introduce testimonial hearsay, and the government did not do that. The government stayed away entirely from the content or substance of the tip and left it at simply that there was a tip that had been made or had been provided to the Department of Homeland Security. And that's
what was the relevance of that?
Again, it was just background to explain why it was that Agent Lubad went to the GVS temples when he did.
Why is that necessary?
Again, it was a guard against an impression that this was arbitrary action by Agent Lubad, by the Department of Homeland Security, or that either he or the department were specifically targeting GVS.
Has it argued that?
No.
See, the problem is, I don't know what's going to happen. The problem is that what you people do, the government prosecutors, is you present inadmissible evidence and you count prejudicial evidence to bolster your case. You count on the harmless error doctrine to bail you out, right? So what I see the government thinking is, as long as a reasonable jury... See, the problem for the government is, if the jury acquits, you're finished. There's no appeal. So you have a case where you believe a reasonable jury would convict, but you don't know whether the jury is reasonable. So in order to make sure that they don't acquit, you put in prejudicial evidence to strengthen your case in the eyes of the jury. And if they convict and the defendant appeals, you argue harmless error. So you have a motive to introduce inadmissible evidence, and you have an escape hatch because you have the harmless error doctrine. That's the problem.
Well, and again, Your Honor...
And the only effective way, apparently, if we didn't abolish the harmless error rule, would be discipline against the lawyers who do this. No, you never seem to do that.
Again, Your Honor, without that testimony about the site visit requirement, it would have appeared as though Agent Lubad had no reason at all for visiting the Milwaukee temples that day. That was the only reason that testimony was elicited. And again, I think it is significant that once it was elicited, the government didn't return in closing argument to argue anything at all about those statistics. Again, they were not mentioned by the government at all in either its closing or its rebuttal closing.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Hanstad. So, Mr. Casper, your time expired, but you can have a minute if you'd like.
So just on the final point that was raised, the government has expressed a concern about a necessary hedge. I think first of all, as Your Honors have pointed out, there was no indication that any hedge was required here, but at maximum, all that would be required is to say that these are routine site visits and move on. There's no need to go into the benefit fraud assessment, any of the percentages, any descriptions of what they found in those 33%, that is the no organization, no temple, that is not necessary for a hedge. As to the comment about the strange religion, the opening brief in which that appears, it is clear in the sentence that the actual quotes to testimony identified as, held out as, are referring to something that was cited and quoted earlier in the paragraph. The second part of that sentence as to strange foreign religion is clearly not purporting to quote anything. They are scare quotes as to the impression potentially left with the jury. As to the comments of the court about the definition of priest, the R1 visa requirements point out three, or I guess you can call them four, including subclasses, only one of which I think you can properly call priest, that would be ministers, but of course that's not specific to a religion. I don't think the word priest is germane necessarily to the Hare Krishna religion, so you're always playing with fire and trying to characterize that. But the religious vocation and religious occupation, which are the third and fourth things separate from the ministerial point that you could classify as priests, the occupation has to do with religious workers. That includes cantors, catechists, etc., and also includes kind of an open-ended thing to accommodate for different religions. As to the religious vocation, that includes, for example, nuns and monks and things of that nature, and people who have taken essentially vows of a certain lifestyle, which there is evidence here that is the kind of thing on both counts that these people were doing and had taken.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Casper, and you were appointed.
Yes, Your Honor.
We thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client.